The time is 6 minutes after noon. It's time for the Punch and Judy Show. Welcome to the Punch and Judy Show. This is your host, Judy Berry, and I'm here with my nearly constant companion, Alicia Littletree.
Hello.
And the Punch and Judy Show is brought to you in part by our members and the Mendocino Environmental Center, a membership organization located on Stanley Street near the courthouse in Ukiah. Their number is 468-1660. Well, I have to start out this week by making a confession, and the confession is that I did something really stupid last week. What I did was I took a cancer drug that's made by Genentech, and I was told that this drug was non-toxic and it might help, but I stupidly believed it, and certainly the name Genentech should have been a clue, and I think that me and Genentech have seriously differing views of what the meaning of the word non-toxic is. Because I spent the last week in hell, I don't even want to describe it, but it was pretty horrible. To say that I had a severe reaction to their non-toxic drug is an understatement, to put it mildly. And I guess that all I can say is, you know, if you lie down with dogs, you're going to wake up with fleas. Or as Marilyn Butcher would put it, you brought it on yourself, Judy. But that's certainly it for me. That's it for Western medicine. That's the last one I'm going to try. But the result is I haven't really gotten all these poisons out of my system, and I'm kind of still in a little bit of a haze, and I'm not quite up to par today. I will tell you this little thing. They said, was I going to take chemotherapy? And I said no. And they said, well, if I did decide to take chemotherapy, would I consider taking a standard IQ test before and after? Because they have a suspicion that it interferes with your cognitive functions. Well, I have a suspicion that this drug that they gave me last week did, because I couldn't even read until yesterday. Fortunately, talking is easier for me than reading, so I am going to attempt to do this show. But I have lower endurance because I'm still kind of in a fog. So what I'm going to do is I'm only going to do half of the show live. And the second half of the show, I'm going to do a pre-recorded tape. But it's not like I'm just like dumping some lousy tape on you to fill up time. This is a tape that I've actually been really waiting for a long time to find time to fit in. And for all the faithful listener out there, that one person who listens to every show, actually maybe even two or three of you might remember this. Several months ago, I did a tape that I had produced with a man named Gene Lawhorn, when I met him, he was a mill worker in Roseburg, Oregon, and a shop steward, and he's a labor historian. He's just the most brilliant labor historian that I know. And we had produced a tape, well, he wrote it, and I did the radio stuff, and we did it together. It was about the frame-up of Sacco and Vanzetti, and it was a really powerful tape. Well, this is another tape that he did with another woman named Leslie Helmstreet, and he did this up at KBOO in Oregon, and it's a tape on women in labor history, and it's really good. It's not it's not just a filler, honest. But anyway, I'm going to do it today, not because I don't have enough information to fill up an hour and a half. I just don't have enough endurance to fill up an hour and a half. So hopefully next week I'll be back to normal and have all these poisons out of my system and be able to do the whole thing and fill in for where we left off. So anyway, that's my first poor news that I have to report, that, you know, my purity was broken and I did something really dumb. Anyway. So the first thing we're going to do today is before I get to the tape, there's a couple things that we're going to do. I have an exciting report from String Creek, where I live, from Robin Rule, and I'll just take her. I won't tell you everything we're going to do first. We'll put Robin on the phone right now. Robin?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hey.
You want to give us your String Creek report?
Yes, the salmon are back, the Chinooks, and...
Yay! But wait,
excited. While I have numbers...
Wait a minute, Robin, before people can appreciate why we're so excited, other than those of us who live on String Creek, you need to tell people how many years it's been since the salmon have made it up to String Creek.
I'm not sure the exact years. I remember seeing them 22 years ago when I first lived up here, and I haven't seen them for a really long time. And... numbers, you know, they don't always mean anything except in baseball and when you can count things like redwoods. But I have some numbers on fish. There were 36 Chinook reported. That doesn't mean That's all there were. It's all that were counted. 10 carcasses, which means they laid their eggs, and 20-some-odd reds, which is their nesting areas. So that means we're going to have more in 3 years because they're on a 3-year cycle. And they're 3.5 feet big. See, Joyce said she's waking up in the morning to the slapping of salmon tails.
That is so awesome. Now, they're not as far up the stream. The farthest I know of them being upstream is at the place where you just described where CJOY lives. Right. I'm sure everybody in Mendocino County knows where that is.
Right. That was from Tomkai up to CJOY, that number count. We walked from our place down to CJOY and Ron's, and we didn't sight any.
Robin, are they still running?
Don't know. The fish and game guy I talked to on the road said if we got one more good rain in the next week or two, we could have another run up Spring Creek.
Well, it looks like one's coming in, so...
So we can look for more slapping in the morning.
Robin, we're not talking about your personal habits here. Anyway, okay, well, that's very, very awesome, and I hope everybody on String Creek Road and even people who aren't on String Creek Road can be excited to hear that news.
Yes, it's good the fish are back.
All right.
All right, have a good show.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Okay, so that was Robin Rule from String Creek Road, and we're supposed to be getting a call in next from Billy Heil, and he's supposed to be calling us, and he better, or he's going to be in big trouble. But anyway, if anybody else wants to call with any other subjects, any other fish that are back in any other stream, or...
Well, the thing that's particularly exciting to me about the salmon run coming back to String Creek is just recently I was up in Olympia, Washington, and I saw my first salmon run ever, and it was truly one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen, just to see these black shadows swooping under the surface of the water and running up the little rippling waterfalls and everything like that. And to know that that is back in my home watershed, I'm just so thrilled. I'm going to be out looking for those fish as soon as I can.
You really, that's really great. Anyway, okay, well, Billy, if you're not going to call in, I'm going to start doing the next update, and that means you're going to have to wait, so I sure hope you call after that one, or else we'll just have to skip you. Anyway, and what Bill's going to call about, Bill, allegedly, what Bill's going to call about, since we don't know where he is, we can't call him. Anyway, but what Bill's supposed to be calling about, of course, is an update on the LP plan to shoot the manzanitas, which they've apparently abandoned, or at least kind of seem to be backing away from. We hope so, at any rate, and the various efforts that have gone on about that over the last week. So, all right, well, we got a call, and we'll see if it's Billy. Okay, caller on the air.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm a little out of breath.
A little slow as usual, we know.
As usual, if you've seen, you know, I'm a day late or a minute.
I'll be in time.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to, last time we talked was last Friday, I believe.
That's right. So why don't you pick us up from then?
Okay. I spent Friday afternoon talking both with Brian Bishop. And
you got to identify these people. He's the LP forester for Albion.
He's the area forester for Louisiana Pacific, and it's his jurisdiction. He's the forester that's in charge of the area that they wanted to inject Roundup into the manzanita out on Table Mountain Road. And he said he'd gotten a call from one of the local people who had suggested hand removal, and so Brian had got in touch with me to see if I was interested, and I tried to get some of the background on what it would take, and I think that's where we left off last week. And I called Tommy Thompson, who's the area manager of this whole area, and he, from talking to him, I felt like he wasn't really serious, but I think by the time he answered a number of calls from concerned citizens, I think that's what he spent last Friday afternoon doing. By evening, he called Brian, not known to me, but he actually called Brian Bishop himself and said, why don't we hold off on that? But since we didn't know that happened, nobody called any of us, we went ahead and planned our demo for Monday morning, and at 7 o'clock, 7:30 Monday morning, 30 people showed up at the end of Albion Ridge and Albion and Table Mountain Road,
which is just really incredible for that hour of the morning and that little amount of notice that people got.
And you know, and as you well know, we organize as best we can, but I felt really good because it was really just like the organic organization of people that were listening to the radio. I was surprised that the people that were there, some I didn't even hadn't even known were interested, and we built a fire and
the best blockade.
Warm and watched the sun come up, and nobody ever showed up. And
you mean nobody from LP ever showed up?
Nobody from LP ever showed up, and But after I'd finished talking to these people Friday afternoon, I decided I was going to drive out to Table Mountain and take a look myself. And so when I drove out there Friday afternoon and started looking at what they wanted to do, the area that I found out from Brian exactly where it was, and started looking at it, I became less and less interested in doing hand removal and became more and more convinced that this was more to try and demonstrate how the EasyJect worked than it was to actually release any of the conifers.
Bill, will you describe what the, how big were the conifers, how big were the manzanitas, how much manzanitas there were?
Particularly, all our forests around here are really site-specific. I mean, when I talk about manzanita and people over inland here, what I'm talking about, it's different than it is right here on the coast where we get so much rain. This manzanita is 20 years old and 20 feet tall and has become just about old-growth manzanita.
All right, yeah, they don't grow them that big on the inland.
Right, and the manzanita does not, I mean, they're always talking about competition, but as far as I can tell, it's not really such a competition problem here this close to the coast because there's so much water, and particularly by the time the manzanita gets this tall, the fir are already, they've grown right along with the manzanita, and now they're like 25 to 30 feet tall, and many of them. There's still some fir that are down in the manzanita, but there's the land almost meets stocking just with the manzanita that's already over top the fir. Not only that, but it turned out that this is an area where during the summer they experimented with hand removal. And when I got out onto that part and looked what had happened, it looks kind of nice there. I mean, they cut down all the manzanita essentially and laid it down. It's almost 3 foot thick on the ground. You have to walk over it, and then they but the firs that they left, the ones that were over top and were growing just fine and it were about to start shading out the manzanita, they look just like they did, except they don't have manzanita around them. They look a little
bare.
They look a bit forlorn actually, and the smaller firs that were really, really struggling for the light yet, and they put all their energy into going up, they're now exposed, and it's a shock for them. And it looks to me like it'll set them back a year or two.
Without their manzanita friends. You know what, Bill, I realized that when we started this conversation, I once again presumed that everybody knew exactly what we were talking about. And what I want to tell people who are listening who may not have heard the show last week or know about this is that this plan we're talking about that people came out to protest in Albion is that LP's plan was to shoot the manzanita trees with a little 22 bullet size pellet of Roundup.
Yeah, it actually comes in a 22 shell, as far as I can tell, and I haven't seen it yet. But
hope you don't.
The nearest to my imagining, if you had a 22 shell and took the powder out and filled it with Roundup, and it must be some pretty concentrated Roundup, and then shot that into the tree, is about what happens. And I found out since. I mean, it turned out that Tuesday evening was the SYP hearing for the inland, the sustained yield plan hearing for the inland holdings of Louisiana Pacific.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting one, too. Mr. Thompson Tommy Thompson was there, and I informed him that I really wasn't interested in wasting my time on doing anything with manzanita that seemed to me to be performing its job admirably and was about to die. You know, I didn't want to shoot it in the back.
Really? What's the lifespan of a manzanita normally?
Right. So,
wait, I asked you a question, so you must not have understood me. What's the lifespan of a manzanita?
Around here, it gets about 30 years.
Okay. So it seems like a really a natural thing just to, you know, cover the earth and provide protection and all that stuff, and then the trees just grow through it.
There are areas right next to this within a quarter mile that look very similar to what this looks now 25 years ago. And now it's got a beautiful stand of fir and redwood, and manzanita is rotten and laying on the ground, except for a few scraggly ones that are still hanging on. But it does a very good job. I also, you know, so, but I told Mr. Thompson that I'm very interested in restoration work. They have thousands of acres of land that needs restoration, but we can't waste our time on doing, you know, on things that look good on the books and are cheap, and, you know, the cheap poison fix. But anyhow, I've discovered the next day that this is a brand new method. They only tried it last year, and it only worked in part. And it worked in where they did it in December and January, and didn't work where they did it later in the year.
Where did they do it?
Somewhere. I think on the Albion, actually, but somewhere out near Comche. I haven't gotten a chance to look. And actually, that was mostly on Ceanothus. So it's just all experimental. And it left me more convinced that the main reason they wanted to shoot this manzanita is that it was the right size.
Right. It was big enough for a .22 bullet to fit in.
Yeah. So, and the sustained yield plan was interesting in that, you know, you've heard of pie charts, right?
Oh, yeah.
They had a lot of pie in the sky charts.
That sounds like LP.
And as far as I can tell, in all of this sustained yield plan stuff, the only thing that is even worth looking at is what they're going to do in the next 10 years. And I think that...
Even that's stretching it. I mean, come on, this is a company that's moving its executive offices out of California. They're
right.
Not going to be around too much longer.
Actually, what it's going to do in the next year or two. But at least because of the amount of outrage that people have expressed, including the Board of Supervisors, they no longer plan to decrease their inventory over the next 10 years.
Well, now, the first time that they submitted their sustained yield plan, which is more than 2 feet thick, used one of their whole forests just to make it, the first time that they submitted it, the plan, incredibly, was that they were going to continue to deplete the forest for the next 30 years, after which it would have a miraculous recovery, and by the end of 100 years, it will have achieved sustained yield. So how did they modify that?
Modify it so they're not going to decrease inventory at all, and I feel that's a real victory. You know, looking back over the year, you know, when we had our Tidewater protest last spring, one of the things we were really protesting was about their planned depletion of the forest lands in Albion, and all the word I'm getting is that they have changed their mind on some of that, and I really feel like it's a victory for the people, and I know at this point it's still a pie-in-the-sky victory, but at least it's looking better.
Yeah, I think that's actually incredible. Even, I mean, hopefully that they'll leave before they destroy the Albion. But the fact that Albion Nation and we Inlanders have helped to, you know, have intimidated them that much so that at least they're going to respect the community a little bit and not just go in and level it, that's really, I mean, I think we have to recognize our victories and claim them.
I think so, too. You know, and I go through a lot of wondering now. You know, it's a lot easier when you're just absolutely consider LP to be Darth Vader and they're the immortal enemy.
I still think they're Darth Vader, but go ahead.
We do have to recognize that when we've actually made some progress. And I think this year as a whole has been an incredible year for the activists. I am amazed at how accepted activism has become as a way of dealing with things.
Really, even the Board of Supervisors threatened Caltrans with our demonstrations in their memo.
That is one, you know, that's incredible. I mean, what I'm seeing is that a certain number of the people that showed up on Monday morning were people who had cut their teeth at Headwaters. They'd been up at Headwaters this summer and understand what it means to be active. And we also had a little demo in Ukiah during the break at the sustained yield plan hearings, and I was amazed 20 people showed up there willing to come out and do a demo in support of the people in Albion, and I want to thank them all again. I want to thank everyone who's been involved in this. I want to thank all the people who took the time to make phone calls last Friday, because these things, these are the things that we can do that really work. And, you know, some of us end up being the voices for what's going on. But unless the people are really doing what needs to be done, those voices don't get listened to.
Bill, we got a phone call, so hold on. Let me take it, okay? Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. This is Linda.
Oh, how nice. You all want to say hi to each other?
Hi. Hi. That the Albion Nation is not a geographical location. Mind?
I'd say that again. I'm sorry. I cut you off.
The Albion Nation is not a geographical location. It is a state of mind. And so it's redundant to say Albion Nation and Inland People.
That's a good point.
Oh, thank you.
We've been trying to be accepted into the Albion Nation for 4.5 years now. So,
there was one thing I wanted to say to Bill and Linda both is that I, as a Headwaters activist and a primary person at base camp and calling the actions and stuff, cut my teeth in Albion with the amazing 9-week sustained uprising of the Albion Nation and the Albion community against Louisiana Pacific, which eventually shut down LP and the entire watershed. So I want to thank you for that incredible experience as well. And we all created that experience, but, you know, it kind of piggybacks off of each other.
Billy, don't you have a song about this? I want to thank you, friend.
To add to Bill's account of what's happening out on the herbicide area in the Albion, and that is that surrounding this ceanothus are some areas that are not growing anything. And from my point of view, what I would like to say to LP is that I think they need to go to these surrounding areas and make some rehabilitation efforts there before they take down the only green stuff.
So you think they need to go and plant manzanita?
Planting manzanita might be a good idea. Putting chip. The soil is badly compacted and eroded, and I'm not sure how you're going to get stuff to grow there at all.
Maybe they could shoot the seeds into the ground in 22 caliber pellets.
Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
it would be very easy within 2 miles from where they wanted to do this injection to find 20 acres of landings that were built back in the 70s when they were using this equipment that they didn't quite understand and thought they had to make these humongous clearings to make it work. And there's 20 acres of bare ground around it that could be brought back into production would be much more useful than trying to kill something out there.
Really?
And that's kind of what I'm really thinking now is that if we can take this energy and if we can figure out some way that the community will get some of the benefit from it, if we could get some of the real restoration work done, not only land that's been bulldozed for landings, but land that's been driven over so that the actual natural regeneration that was trying to come back is now really struggling in places where they just cut down all the oaks and there are humongous bushes of oak coming up ahead of everything else. If we could figure out something to do in these areas, it would be to the benefit of everyone.
All right. Well, I know LP keeps expecting you to hire crews for them. maybe eventually they'll just turn the land over like they ought to.
Well, I'd love to see that. I mean, that's what we, Linda, you know, what happens when, of course, when you start talking business with these people, they start talking insurance and God knows what, and it becomes you get sucked right into the system. What I'd like to see them do is actually lease us some areas for 20 years or something where we could actually do the work and that we'd be assured that somewhere down the line we would get the benefit from it. Not that they wouldn't get some benefit too, but that the communities could benefit. It's one of the hardest things about living in a third world country is that all the resources get shipped out to desert hot springs or someplace.
Really, that's for sure. Okay, well, Bill, we're going to have to move on. So, you got any final wrap up?
Okay, I just want to thank everyone for all the incredible work they've done, and wish everybody Merry Christmas or happy holidays, I suppose.
And solstice. Don't forget solstice.
a good solstice and a good new year, and that things got, you know, maybe finally the tables are starting to turn.
Yeah, well, it is feeling good, even though we're sounding a little mushy here. I totally agree with you, and it's great to live in a community like this.
Okay,
thanks. Okay, that was Bill Heil from the Albion Nation State of Mind, and joined by Linda Perkins and Judy and Alicia, all from the Albion Nation State of Mind. And the next update I have to do, I got to do myself, and I'm so excited about this. This is just awesome. And the reason I have to give you this update myself is because these are up-to-the-minute updates on what's going on in Geronimo Pratt's trial down in Los Angeles. And I've been very privileged to have been called regularly by people who have been attending it. And it's really exciting what's going on there. We've heard snitches of it on the news on Pacifica, but not really what's going on. I've reported on this a couple weeks ago. I had Timothy Pratt, Geronimo's brother, on, and we talked about what was coming up in this case. Geronimo, of course, has been in jail for 25 years now for a crime that he definitely didn't commit. The FBI knows that he didn't commit, but the FBI, in fact, Richard Held himself, the same man in charge of my case, framed him for it knowingly and deliberately. And for all this time, they haven't been able to get another trial. Well, finally, they've gotten this case back to trial. They're having an evidentiary hearing to decide whether to have another trial. And what they have to prove in order to win a trial, they need to prove three things. They have to prove that Julius Butler, who was one of the principal witnesses against Geronimo Pratt, who helped convict him, they need to prove that Julius Butler was an informant, which, of course, he was, and it's well known. They have to prove that the district attorney's office knew that he was an informant, and they have to prove that the district attorney's office did not tell the jury that the principal witness was a police informant. Now, it's well known that Julius Butler is an FBI informant. That's been known for years and years, but what recently came out was he was also an informant to the Los Angeles police's own, to the Los Angeles police, that the district attorney's office from Los Angeles certainly knew that this man was an informant because he was their informant, not just the FBI's informant. And they came up with these informant cards that they kept. And on the list of informant cards, Julius Butler was one of the people who had a card listed as an informant. So this kind of caused a little problem. And there was a man in the district attorney's office at the time. His name was Kalustian. I didn't write down his first name. Sorry, last name's hard enough. Anyway, so the name Julius Butler listed on an informant card was in Kalustian's handwriting. Kalustian got up on the stand, however, and testified that, well, yeah, there is this card that says it in my handwriting, but first he had said he doesn't recall how Julius Butler's name got on the informant card, and the judge had actually said, I don't recall is not a good enough answer, and boy, I wish someone would say that in our case. Anyway, so Kalustian got up on the stand, and he said, well, yeah, this is Julius Butler's name on an informant card in his own handwriting, but that doesn't really mean he was an informant. It just meant they might have used him. They were considering him as using one, maybe, but that he never got any information from Julius Butler and that he really, you know, didn't consider him an informant. So then there was another man from the same office. I'm not sure if these people are police or DAs. I'm sorry, I don't have all these details. But when this trial's over, I'll have a firsthand report and we'll get it all straight. But anyway, so they got another guy up on the stand, and his name was Willis. And I think he was another policeman from the LA police. And Willis testified that you only get your name on an informant card if you are an informant, not if you're considered as a potential informant. And Willis said that he did indeed get information from Julius Butler himself and that he considered Julius Butler an informant. Well, the district attorney's office then got to cross-examine Willis and seemed to be discrediting him. They said, well, if you got information from Julius Butler, did you write a report? And the answer was no. Well, why didn't you write a report? Oh, well, because I already knew the information that Julius Butler gave me. And it was beginning to kind of erode his credibility and sound like maybe he wasn't being quite straight. So after that, they had a break, and one of the people who's called me from this trial is Wesley Swearingen. And again, the long-term faithful listeners of the show will remember that he is an FBI agent who resigned because he got disgusted. He worked with Richard Held, and he was disgusted particularly by the framing of Geronimo Pratt, and eventually his conscience got to him, and he resigned, and he wrote a book about being a COINTELPRO agent, and I've had him on this show before. I'll have him on again after this trial so we can hear from him. Well, he's down there helping with the defense. So they had a little break, and he proudly told me that he wrote the questions for the next set of questions for Johnny Cochran, who is now Geronimo's lawyer, to ask. And that what he did is he based it on all the little FBI rules, and he said they put the guy Kalustian back up on the stand, and they said, okay, well, did you have any rules that said that that if you got any information from an informant, then you had to write a report? And the answer was no, we didn't have any rules like that. Did you have any directives? No. If you got the same information from five people, did you have to write five reports or one report? And the answer was one report. So through the cross-examination and the knowledge of kind of informant procedures, they were able to rehabilitate their witness that it was not unusual that he hadn't kept any records, that he didn't write any reports, even though he had gotten information from Julius Butler. So anyway, the reason that, so that was all going very well, and everybody who's down there is very excited. There's a lot of people down there. Kathleen Cleaver is down there. Ashake Pratt, who's Geronimo's wife, is down there. Timothy, his brother, who was on the show, is down there. My one of my lawyers in my FBI case, Bob Bloom, has been down there. He's also worked on Geronimo's case. And everybody that I've talked to, I haven't talked to all those people, obviously, but people are very excited. They say they hesitate to have this much hope because it's been so long, but they're very, very hopeful. They feel that it's going so well. Also, Wes Swearingen told me that Geronimo has won the right to wear a suit to court, and that he's the best-dressed person in the courtroom, except for Johnny Cochran, who, of course, is going to be the best-dressed person in the courtroom. The reason that Wes Swearingen called me is because they are considering subpoenaing Richard Held to be in this, to testify in this hearing, and he wanted to know if I knew how to get in touch with Richard Held, with Dick. As a matter of fact, I think I provided them some helpful information. So we're hoping that not only will this trial, which is still going on, will still be going on. I don't know when it's going to end. It's the other thing they said is that they've allowed a lot of testimony about Julius Butler's record as an FBI informant, not just as a district attorney's informant. So you know, there's always the thing that, like, Judge Luther always does that in this county. You know, he rules everything in our favor on the procedural stuff and gives us every chance in the world and then rules against us. So everybody is aware of that dynamic and is hesitant to make good predictions. But people are very excited, and the trial is just really awesome that it's even happening and that these things are coming out, and it's going to go on probably, well, you know, there'll be a Christmas break and all that, so at least for the next week, I think it'll be, we don't know exactly when it's over, but whenever it's over, we will have some eyewitness or other, or maybe several of them, on and give you an absolutely first hand account, and maybe, who knows, someday Geronimo may be free.
What happens if he wins this trial?
If Geronimo wins, he's free.
This particular trial?
Oh, no. If he wins this trial, then they hold a rehearing on whether he should be in jail. This hearing is just to determine whether they have enough evidence to hold a hearing, which they should have done this all long ago, but you know the way they like to stall and they're so conservative. So anyway, but if they actually hold a hearing in which the real evidence is able to be presented, this evidence includes the fact that the FBI possesses wiretap records of their own that show that they knew that Geronimo was in Oakland at the time that they claimed that he was killing someone in Santa Monica. So if he ever gets to present the evidence, there's no way he could be convicted. So anyway, that's the exciting Geronimo report, and I'm getting out my 20-year-old free Geronimo button and hoping away, so maybe we'll get some good news on that account. That would be just the most awesome thing in the world. Anyway, so now we're going to have to start this tape in a minute because we're almost up to the time that we need. And what I want to say about it is this is a tape. I told you who Gene Lawhorn is, who is the producer of this tape. He's just a brilliant labor historian and just a brilliant working-class spokesperson, really. This tape is about history. It's about working-class history and certainly things you're not going to learn in school. But what's really important about this tape is that it's not just about history. It's about kind of the past, where we came from. It's about much worse atrocities than we usually hear about today. Not that atrocities don't go on today, but it's important to remember that atrocities do indeed go on today in workplaces right in our county, as Don Hensley and his relatives and co-workers certainly know from Retech. And I want to say that I think that a lot of people who don't work in that kind of job just can't even imagine it. I know I did my stint in factories and stuff like that, so I really got my education on this firsthand. And
I want to say that I'm very interested in learning about these kind of conditions. I mean, not only we have this outrage of Don Hensley, who was killed mixing toxic chemicals without any radioactive chemicals, nuclear chemicals, without any kind of control. You know, I'm sure some of you remember several years back we had the incident of Fortunato Reyes and the in Ukiah LP mill, who was killed after being ridiculed by his supervisor and told not to push the emergency stop too much because he was slowing down production, and he tried to break a jam without pushing the stop and was crushed behind the lumber. We had the PCB spill and the Fort Bragg mill, and there's many, many other incidences like this. And even without the incidences, just the day-to-day life of working in these big plants, a lot of people do not know what goes on in them, not just Retec, Masonite, all of them, you name them. And if there's anybody out here who's listening to this show who works in one of those factories and would like to come on the show and just describe your working conditions, I'd be very happy to do that anonymously if you want to, so that you won't get in trouble. And you can put a handkerchief over the phone if if you want to distort your voice. But anyway, or we'll use a scrambler or something. But anyway, I'd be very interested in having your working conditions known to people who don't work in those kind of jobs. I think that we need to be aware of these things, and I think that's the way that we can improve our conditions. So if there's anyone out there who either works in one of those places, has worked in one of those places, or has a relative who works in one of those places, and it doesn't have to be the name ones I name, any industrial kind of job in this county, with or agricultural type of job in this county, in which these conditions, we've had a man on here describe what it was like to work on a Garland spray crew. It was shocking. So if you have any of those experiences that you may consider too common to talk about, I don't consider them too common to talk about, and I think the people who listen to this show would be very interested in hearing also. So if you would like to tell your story, then please call this radio station after the show, or you can do it while the tape's running, at 895-2448, or you can call during business hours and leave a message for me at 895-2324, and I'd love to put your story on the air. If anyone was working with Don Hensley when he was killed, boy, we'd really like to hear what happened. So anyway, with that, I think I'm going to start this tape. And if you think that this isn't something that you want to listen to, give it a little while. Give it 10 minutes. When you get to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, I think even if you think you're not interested in this, you're going to change your mind. It's a really cool tape. So, but you're just going to have to tolerate the first song because it's a little bit long. But other than that, it's a really great tape. So let me get all these little buttons together. And this is Jean Lawhorn and Leslie Helmstreet on Women in Labor History.
Company thinks our deputy sheriff's that make a rage. He went to the union hall when a meeting it was called. And when the Legion boys come round, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union.
Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union till the day I die. She went to the picket line one morning just at nine, and the guards and ginks and company things came skipping through the morning dew. They had their clubs and guns, they had their knives and bombs. They stood as still as if they did when she jumped up and said,
oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union.
Keep going.
I'm sticking by the union.
Yay, sister.
I'm sticking by the union.
Say it again.
Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union.
Right on, sister.
I'm sticking by the union till the day I die.
When the union boys, they seen this pretty little union queen stand up and sing in the deputy's face, they laughed and yelled all over the place. And you know what they'd done, these two gun company thugs. When they heard this union song, they tucked their tail and run.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union.
That's right, sister.
Sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union.
Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union till the day I die.
In 1972, workers walked out at a university. We stayed away for 68 days and liberated the building trades. At the start, our leaders told us, brothers, stand together. And an awful hiss went through the hall. Half of us were sisters. But at the end, they told us, we have stood together, brothers and sisters. And here's our song.
We modern union maids are also not afraid to walk the line, leap
jobs behind, and we're not just the ladies' aid. We fight for equal pay, and we will have our say. We're workers to the same as you, and fight the union way.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the union.
Child care
sector,
maternity leave,
by the union.
Equal pay.
Oh, no, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the union.
Women on the
executive board. Till the day I die.
Don't call us dear or honey, or little lady sunny. We're women free with dignity, no cutie playboy bunny. So neither are we men, so listen once again.
If you call us brother, we'll call you mother.
Sister is the name. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union. Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking by the union. I'm sticking by the union till the day I die.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. You're listening to 90.7 KBOO in Portland, Oregon, and my name is Gene Lawhorn.
And of course, you know you're not listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. You are listening to KZYX in Philo, and that was Gene Lawhorn, and we'll go on with them.
And I'm Leslie Hemstreet.
And we're here to talk about women in labor history today. And we're going to be talking for about the first hour, so we're not going to be taking any phone calls for the first hour or so. So don't call. Just listen for a while.
Imagine this. Descending for an hour, maybe a half an hour every day down a ladder into the depths of the earth, half naked with a basket on your head. For light, all you have is a candle on a stick protruding from your mouth. When you fill the basket with coal, you have to climb back up the ladder. Beside the hot, hard work of loading the coal and carrying it through low tunnels and then climbing the long, rickety ladders, there is a dangerous possibility of cave-ins, coal dust, and explosive or poisonous gases. These are the conditions that Europe's first coal miners, women and children, found themselves in during the 1700s and early 1800s.
Frederick Engels, in his classic book, The Conditions of the Working Class in England, says the usual working day in the mines was 11 to 12 hours. Often in Scotland, it reaches 14 hours, and double time is frequent when all employees are below the ground. Sometimes they'll work 24 to 36 hours straight without a break. This European model of long hours and harsh working conditions in the growing industrial revolution would find its way to the New World with a vengeance.
So it goes. In 1790, English mechanic Samuel Slater built the first cotton mill in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. His first nine operators were seven boys and two girls under the age of 12.
By 1810, there were 87 of these cotton mills employing about 500 people and 3,500 women and children. In 1812, Francis Cabot Lowell, an exporting and importing merchant, developed the first power loom in the United States. It was Lowell and his corporate partners, the Boston Associates, that instituted a company boarding house system which employed predominantly young women from rural farms.
The boarding house doors were locked every night at 10 o'clock. The women were required to follow a strict religious routine. The workday was 12 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. In other mills, it was 7 days a week. They worked in narrow, badly ventilated buildings. The windows were nailed shut, and smoke from oil lamps with cotton dust hung thick in the air.
On the subject of wages, Philip Foner, in his book, Women and the American Labor Movement, Volume 1, says, there was no firmly established going rate. Wages were set high enough to induce young women to leave farms and stay away from competing employment, but low enough to offer the owner an advantage in employing women. The factory girls, as they were known and called themselves, were paid piece rate, averaging $1.75 a week before deductions for boarding, sick funds, and fines. Most of the mills paid in company scrip, redeemable only at company stores at grossly inflated prices. Men, Foner says, were paid $0.85 a day for an operator and $2 a day for an overseer, which was also known as the moral policeman.
The boarding houses were crowded. There were 12 to a room, 2 to a bed. The factory girls could be fired for immoral conduct, which often meant not acquiescing to the sexual demands of the moral policeman, the all-powerful overseer. It also referred to lying, drinking, smoking, failure to attend church services, suspicious character, whatever that means, hysteria, impudence, and last but not least, expressing dissatisfaction over wages or working conditions. A woman named Elizabeth Wilson was fired for being a, quote, devil in petticoats, whatever that means. After being fired, a woman's name was placed on a blacklist, which was circulated through all the mill towns.
Long hours, low wages, and dangerous working conditions. This was the standard set by America's early industries. From the beginning of the citizen and worker opposition to these conditions, women were to play an important role in a bloody battle between the classes.
Today's program is dedicated to exploring the lives, work, and tragic circumstances of some of the women who were active in this nation's longest standing war, the class war. There is no better place to begin to explore women's impact in American history than the Revolutionary War.
In 1765, this nation's first society of white working women was organized as an auxiliary to the Sons of Liberty, the Daughters of Liberty. They actively promoted boycotts of English goods, held spinning bees to make cloth for soldiers of the Continental Army, after a pitcher of water from a cool spring nearby to the troops.
Servant ape the terrible, raging inferno within the...
...aped falling, waving her arms, trying to keep her body upright in each window. Come, we yelled, don't jump, stay there. One girl climbed into the window sash. Those behind her tried to hold her back. Then she dropped into space. I didn't notice whether those above watched her drop. I turned my head away. Then came the first thud. I looked up. Another girl was climbing onto the window sill. Others were crowding behind her. She dropped. I watched her fall, and again the dreadful sound. Two windows away, two girls were climbing onto a sill. They were fighting each other and crowding for air. Behind them I saw many screaming heads. They fell almost together, but I heard two distinct thuds. Then the flames burst out through the windows and the floor below them and curled up into their faces. The firemen began to raise a ladder. Others took a life net, and while they were rushing into the sidewalk with it, two more girls shot down. The firemen held it under them. The bodies broke it. Before they could move the net, another girl's body flashed through it. The thuds were just as loud. It seemed as if there was no net there. It seemed to me that the thuds were so loud that they might be heard all over the city. As I looked up, I saw a love affair in the midst of all the horror. A young man helped a girl to the windowsill. Then he held her out deliberately away from the building and let her drop. He seemed cool and calculating. He held out a second girl the same way and let her drop. Then he held out a third girl who did not resist. I noticed that. They were as unresisting as if he were helping them into a streetcar instead of eternity. Undoubtedly, he saw a terrible death awaited them in the flames, and this was his only terrible chivalry. Then came the love amid the flames. He brought another girl to the window. Those of us who were looking saw her put her arms around him and kiss him. Then he held her out into space and dropped her. But quick as a flash, he was on the windowsill himself. His cloak fluttered upward. The air filled his trousers. Thud dead, thud dead. Together, they went into eternity. We found out later, in the room in which he stood, many girls were being burned to death by the flames, were screaming in an inferno of heat. He chose the easiest way and was brave enough to even help the girl he loved to a quicker death after she had given him a goodbye kiss. He leaped with the energy as if to arrive first in that mysterious land of eternity, but her thud dead came first. I heard the screams around the corner and hurried there. What I had seen before was not so terrible as what followed. Up on the ninth floor, the girls were burning to death before our very eyes. They were jammed in windows. No one was lucky enough to be able to jump, it seemed. But one by one, the jams broke. Down came the bodies in a shower of burning, smoking, flaming bodies with disheveled hair trailing upward. They had fought each other to die by jumping instead of by fire. On the sidewalk lay heaps of broken bodies. A policeman later went about with tags where he fastened with wires to the wrists of the dead girls, numbering each with a lead pencil. I saw him fasten tag number 54 to the wrist of a girl who wore an engagement ring. A fireman who came downstairs from the building told me that there were at least 50 bodies in a big room on the seventh floor. Another fireman told me more girls had jumped down an air shaft at the rear of the building. I went back there into the narrow court and saw a heap of dead girls. The floods of water from the fireman's hose that ran it together were actually stained red with blood. I looked upon the heap of dead bodies and I remembered these girls were the shirtwaist makers. I remembered their great strike of last year in which these same girls had demanded more sanitary and safe precautions in the shops. These dead bodies were the answer.
Addressing a memorial meeting for these women at the Metropolitan Opera House, this is a speech by Rose Schneiderman, who was an organizer for the ILGWU and the Women's Trade Union League. And her speech is called We Have Found You Wanting. This is what she told the people. I would be a traitor to these poor, burned bodies if I came here to talk good fellowship. We have tried, you good people of the public, and we have found you wanting. The old Inquisition had its rack and its thumbscrews and its instruments of torture with iron teeth. We know what these things are today. The iron teeth are our necessities. The thumbscrews are the high-powered and swift machinery close to which we must work. And the rack is here in the fire trap structures that will destroy us the minute they catch on fire. This is not the first time girls have been burned alive in this city. Every week I must learn of the untimely death of one of my sister workers. Every year thousands of us are maimed. The life of men and women is so cheap and property is so sacred. There are so many of us for one job. It matters little if 146 of us are burned to death. We have tried, you citizens. We are trying you now. And you have a couple of dollars for the sorrowing mothers, brothers, and sisters by way of a charity gift. But every time the workers come out, and the only way they know how to protest against the conditions which are unbearable, the strong hand of the law is allowed to press down heavily upon us. Public officials have only words of warning to us, warning that we must be intensely peaceable, and they have the workhouse just back of all their warnings. The strong hand of the law beats us back when we rise into the conditions that make life unbearable. I can't talk fellowship to you who are gathered here. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from my experience, it is up to the working people to save themselves. The only way they can save themselves is by a strong working class movement.
On April 5th, 10 days after the fire which killed 145 young women and one man, 170,000 rain-soaked marchers participated in a very solemn funeral parade. It is estimated that over 500,000 people lined Fifth Avenue to watch the parade.
The owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, Max Blank and his partner Isaac Harris, were tried on manslaughter charges. The trial lasted 3 weeks. At the end of the trial, according to Barbara Mayer Wertheimer's book, We Were There, the judge, Thomas Crane, charged the jury to find the owners guilty only if they believed all the doors in the factory were locked at all times during the working day and at leaving time. And if Margaret Schwartz, a dead worker who represented all those who died, would have lived if the door had not been locked.
Under these said ambiguous terms, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. In commenting on the verdict, a radical newspaper, the New York Call, said, "Capital can commit no crime when it is in the pursuit of profits." As you shall soon see, that statement historically reaffirms itself over and over again.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Massacre galvanized the labor community, especially the women. Thus, many of the fire safety laws instituted today are a direct result of the activism following the Triangle Fire. And still, factory owners had to be dragged along, kicking and screaming every step of the way. Despite fire and workplace safety laws, workers continue to be massacred in the workplace. For example, 25 women were killed in a textile shop in New York in 1958. And don't forget the chicken factory workers of North Carolina a couple of years ago.
Next, we shall profile a few individual women of great courage, women who inspire us when times get hard.
Oh, you mean times like these?
Yes. It is our hope that their stories will inspire you all who are listening.
And awaken you all to the fact that there is much more to history.
Or herstory.
Than was ever filtered to you in our wonderful education system.
Right now, I'd like to take the time to remind you that you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. And you're listening to Jean Lawhorn.
And Leslie Hemstreet.
And we're talking about women in labor history.
And once again, I have to tell you that you're not listening to KBOO. You're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo and KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah. Also K202BE Fort Bragg at 88.3 FM. Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. We're listening to a tape of Jean Lawhorn and Leslie Hemstreet from KBOO up in Portland doing one of their labor history shows on women in labor history. And I just got a call. This is Judy Berry. And I just got a call to remind people listening that that doors are often still locked in many factories. In fact, the chicken factory that Leslie just referred to that the workers were killed in a couple years ago, that was exactly the issue. The doors were locked and people couldn't get out. So back to the tape.
And next we'll hear a song from Woody Guthrie, The Massacre of 1913.
Take a trip with me in 1913 to Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, and the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I'll take you in a door and up a high stairs. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I'll let you shake hands with the people you see and watch the kids dance round the big Christmas tree. You ask about work and you ask about pay. They'll tell you they make less than a dollar a day. Working their copper claim, risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with children and wives. There's talking and laughing and songs in the air. And the spirit of Christmas is there everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all. And you're dancing around and around in the hall. Well, a little girl sits down by the Christmas tree lights to play the piano, so you gotta keep quiet. Hear all this fun, you would not realize that the copper boss thug men are milling outside. The copper boss thug stuck their heads in the door. One of them yelled and he screamed, there's a fire. A lady, she hollered, there's no such a thing. Keep on with your party, there's no such a thing. A few people rushed and it's only a few. It's just the thugs and the scabs fooling you. A man grabbed his daughter and he carried her down. But the thugs held the door and he could not get out. And then others followed, 100 or more. But most everybody remained on the floor. The gun thugs, they laughed at their murderous joke, while the children were smothered on the stairs by the door. Such a terrible sight I never did see. We carried our children back up to their tree. The scabs outside still laughed at their spree. And the children had died, there was 73. The piano played a slow funeral tune. and the town is lit up by a cold Christmas moon. The parents, they cried, and the miners, they moaned. See what your greed for money has done.
In July of 1913, the copper miners of the Western Federation of Miners working for the Calumet Hecla Mining Company went on a strike in Calumet, Michigan. Their demands were for the 8-hour day, an increase of 35 cents a day for above-ground workers, a minimum working day wage of $3,
and the abolition of the
newly instituted one-man drill system known to the workers as the Widowmaker or Mankiller. 21 mines shut down, and over 16,000 miners walked out.
Under the request of the local sheriff, the governor sent in over 2,000 National Guardsmen. Add to that 2,000 deputized men and hundreds of strike-breaking detectives of the notorious Waddell Mahon Agency. And to spice up this recipe for disaster, the local businessmen organized themselves into a group called the Citizens Alliance. All this adds up to for the creation of a totally repressive police state whose reason for existence is to break the strike by any violent means they deemed necessary.
Enter our heroine, Anna Klemenic, the wife of a Croatian miner, who with other miners formed the antithesis to the Citizens Alliance called simply the Woman's Alliance. Anna was known to the strikers as Big Annie or Tall Annie. Some labeled her as the American Joan of Arc because of her tireless work in support of the strike. Philip Foner, in Volume 5 of his History of the Labor Movement in the United States, says, Annie was attacked more than once by infantrymen with bayoneted guns, by cavalrymen with drawn sabers, and by Waddell-trained deputies with pistols and clubs. Their aim was to get her to drop the American flag she carried at the head of the miners' parades. But Annie stood her ground.
Kill me!
She shouted to the infantrymen and deputies as they tried to seize her flag.
Run your bayonets and sabers through this flag and kill me, but I won't move. If this flag won't protect me, then I will die with it.
The attackers were forced to retreat, but on another occasion when two soldiers struck her with their bayonets, one on the wrist and the other in the breast, to force her to drop the flag she was carrying, she raised the staff horizontally, letting its folds fall down in front of her, and said,
Go ahead now, do your dirty work. Shoot me. I am willing to die behind this flag. If you don't respect this flag, I do.
This time, one of the soldiers, seeing that she was not to be scared or driven from the field, clubbed her over the shoulder with a rifle stock. A number of strikers, seeing that she was in real danger, pushed her from the soldier's path. Again, that paragraph was from Philip Foner's History of the Labor Movement in United States, Volume Number 5. At one point in the strike, Annie was arrested for violating an injunction as she and other women tried to peacefully talk to a group of workers, also known as scabs, who were returning to the miners, to the mines. A carload of soldiers pulled up and asked her to leave. The following account of the arrest is from Annie's own words, taken from the October issue of the Miners' Bulletin.
I was standing to one side of the crowd, and he said,
You have to get in the auto.
I won't go until you tell me the reason. Then he made me get into the auto. I kept pounding the automobile with my feet and asking what I was being taken to jail for. The officer said,
Why don't you stay home?
I won't stay at home. My work is here. Nobody can stop me. I'm going to keep at it until this strike is won. I was kept in jail from 6:30 until 12 and then released on bond.
After Annie's release, the Women's Alliance sent appeals out to other unions for help, and soon gifts, clothing, and food began to pour in. So they also began to organize for a Christmas party for the children of the miners. The second floor of the Italian Hall in Red Jacket, Michigan, was rented for the party. Between 700 and 1,000 miners, their wives and children attended the party, complete with a Santa Claus and three Christmas trees. Shortly before the fire was, before the party was to start, someone rushed in and yelled, Fire! 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 When there was, in fact, no fire at all.
Panic ensued. People began running, pushing, shoving, and screaming towards the only exit, a very narrow staircase, which quickly became jammed with bodies. Firemen who were alerted by an alarm rushed to the scene, only to have rescue efforts blocked by Citizens Alliance members who watched outside and cheered. When the firemen finally got through and began rescue efforts, they found 62 dead children and 11 dead adults.
From Philip Foner's aforementioned book, on Sunday after Christmas, mass services were held for the dead children and adults. Then, 50,000 people in a procession of the funeral wound its way to the Lakeview Cemetery, 2 miles away.
At the head of the procession, carrying the same American flag she had borne so many times in strikers' parades, walked Annie Klemenik, tears streaming from her eyes.
The next woman we shall profile is Fanny Mooney Sellens. Her life spanned from 1872 to 1919, 47 of the most tumultuous years in the history of American labor. As a young woman with four children, Fanny's husband died, so she went to work in a St. Louis garment shop. There she joined a union and became secretary of her local. In 1913, she became the second woman to work as an organizer for the United Mine Workers, the first being the great Mother Jones.
My job was to distribute clothing and food to starving women and babies, to assist poverty-stricken mothers and bring children into the world, and to minister to the sick and close the eyes of the dying.
According to Philip Foner in his book, Mother Jones Speaks, she was arrested for violating an injunction. She was chastised by the judge, who warned her not to emulate Mother Jones, but she proceeded to do just exactly that, telling a meeting of strikers and sympathizers,
"I am free, and I have a right to walk or talk any place in this country as long as I obey the law. I have done nothing wrong. The only thing I can say I have done is to take shoes to the little children in colliers who need shoes. And when I think of their little bare feet blue with the cruel blast of winter, it makes me determined that if it be wrong to put shoes upon those little feet, then I will continue to do wrong as long as I have hands and feet to crawl to colliers."
For inciting a riot, Fanny was sentenced to a long prison term. She did 6 months and then was pardoned by President Wilson. After getting out of jail, she was sent to Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, to work as an organizer for District 5 of the United Mine Workers. There she became secretary of the Allegheny Trades Council.
In 1919, the coal miners of the Allegheny Coal and Coke Company went on strike in West Natona against wage cuts. On August 26, a group of strikers standing picket duty were rushed upon by coal company thugs and a mine official who opened fire, killing one striker. Fanny Sellens, who was present, saw a group of children in harm's way, so she escorted them to safety. And then she returned to find the thugs beating an older striker, Joe Strzelecki. Fanny rushed to his aid, pleading with them to stop. The mine official struck her on the head, knocking her down. As she attempted to drag herself away, the mine official yelled,
"Kill that goddamn whore!"
At which time, one of the mine guards fired 3 shots into Fanny's body.
"Give her more,"
he ordered again. Then, according to eyewitness accounts, one of the guards standing over her motionless body held his gun down without averting his face and fired into her once more. Another guard picked up her hat and danced a step and said to the crowd,
"I'm Fanny Sellens now."
Then, according to Philip Foner in Mother Jones Speaks, a truck pulled up and the mine guards threw in the body of Strzelecki, then grabbed Fanny Sellens' body by the heels and drug her to the truck before throwing her in, took a club and crushed her skull before the eyes of witnesses who stood powerless before a throng of armed men.
Despite the many eyewitnesses, the executioners of Fanny Sellens were never brought to trial. They were arrested at one point, but released on smaller bonds than the strikers who had violated the injunctions. Eventually, they were all freed without any charges. On the 19th anniversary of her execution, August 26, 1938, District 5 of the United Mine Workers erected a monument as tribute to her, inscribed with these words,
"Faithful ever to the cause of labor, all of us deeply regret the fate you met. Nobly you fought the fight against greed and gain, never flinching with your efforts when the bullets came. Immortal to miners shall ever be thy name, embellished in their hearts the sacrifice you made.
The last woman we will profile is Ella Mae Wiggins of Gastonia, North Carolina. She lived from 1900 to 1929. Ella Mae was forced to move from rural North Carolina with 9 children after her husband died from long-suffering injuries incurred from a logging accident. She got a job working 60 hours a week in a cotton mill. Her older children had to watch the younger children while she worked, something that's come full circle around in today's society. 4 of her children became very ill, so she had to quit work to care for them, only to find that she could not afford the medicine for him. Of that experience, Ella Mae once told a reporter,
"So they just died. I never could do anything for my children, not even keep them alive, it seems. That's why I'm for the union, so's I can do better for them."
Ella Mae joined the National Textile Workers Union and became well known as a balladeer singing union and strike songs on the picket lines of the workers striking against the Manville Jinkies Company to the tune of old mountain folk songs.
One reporter during that time described Ella Mae as a slightly built woman, rather short, with lively brown eyes. She had a clear, true tone in her untaught, untrained voice, an unmodulated vibrancy that touched the emotion more nearly than the purer note of trained singers. He said her songs traveled through the textile towns, telling better than the speeches and leaflets of the people's faith in the union to give them a better life.
Ella Mae was one of the few Southern Union organizers who felt organizing African Americans into the union was important. She worked hard to earn their trust and was able to get enough union cards signed to hold a meeting. But the company got wind of her efforts and distributed race-baiting handbills to divide the white workers from their black co-workers, thus defeating her efforts of uniting blacks and whites to fight a common enemy.
Shortly after, the strikers were evicted from their company-owned homes, and they set up tent colonies. On June 7th, a carload of drunken policemen, including the chief, invaded the tent colony, which had set up armed guards to protect themselves from company thugs. Without cause, a deputy opened fire, and thus a shootout incurred, in which the chief was killed and 3 policemen were wounded. Woo-hoo! 16 were indicated for murder, including 3 women, Amy Schechter, Sophie Melvin, and Vera Buick Weisbord, all seasoned veterans of numerous labor disputes.
The fact that 16 workers framed on murder charges include 3 women, wrote the Daily Worker, shows the important role that women were playing in the class struggle, fighting side by side with the men on the picket line, starving with them, and sharing with them the brutal attacks of the police. They are being selected for special victimization equally with the men.
This event and the subsequent mistrial of the 16 framed-up workers arrested for murder set off a chain of reactionary events which culminated in vigilante attacks by supporters of the company against the union headquarters in Gastonia and Bessemer City, where union leaders were kidnapped and beaten.
To counter these attacks, the National Textile Workers Union organized a rally to be held in Gastonia on September 14th. En route to attend the rally, a truckload of strikers and supporters were turned around by a group of armed men, then chased by 10 carloads of vigilantes. The truck came upon a roadblock and was forced to stop. Then the unarmed, peaceful strikers were fired upon. Killed in this attack was organizer, balladeer, and mother of 5 children, Ella Mae Wiggins. At Ella Mae's funeral, fellow worker Kate Barnett sang Ella's favorite song, The Mill Mother's Lament.
We leave our homes in the morning. We kiss our children goodbye. While we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocery bill to pay, not a cent to spend for clothing, not a cent to lay away. And on that very evening, our little son will say, I need some shoes, dear mother, and so does Sister May. How it grieves the heart of a mother, you everyone must know, But we cannot buy for our children. Our wages are too low. Now listen to me, workers, both you women and you men. Let us win for them the victory. I'm sure 'twill be no sin.
Eulogizing for LMA, National Textile Workers Union organizer Doug Martin recounted what LMA once told him about her reasons for being in the union.
I want the children to live a decenter life than what I did. I'm fighting for better conditions for my children. I want them to get some educating and have a better chance than I ever got. I want to learn them to be good union leaders and stick to their fellow workers.
Like the preceding profiles, none of the executioners were ever brought to justice. In the murder trial of this police chief, seven people were found guilty and sentenced to 17 to 20 years. Charges were dropped against the women due in large part to national protest. This program does not permit the time to go into the necessary details about the many other outrages, murders, and massacres perpetuated against the working class in this nation's short history. But in the future, we hope to recount the stories of the Sugar Workers Massacre, the Molly Maguire's frame-up, the Haymarket Massacre, the Elaine Massacre, the Verdun Battle, and the Ludlow Massacre, where two women and 11 children were killed, burned to death, while ducking Colorado National Guard bullets. Their names are Patricia Valdez, whose four children perished with her, and said Delano Costa, who was 7 months pregnant. Two of her children perished with her. The history and herstory of the American working class is a history and herstory of blood and war. Many times over, our fathers, grandfathers, mothers, and grandmothers have paid the price with their lives for what little social benefits we do receive on the job and in society. And each year, day by day, the greed masters of corporate America take more and more away and give us less and less for the takings. Less wages, less benefits, less clean water, less clean air, less job safety, less compensation for accidents, less trees, less diversity of life, and less self-worth. So let's keep our sense of history and our sense of herstory. We the working class, man, woman, child, white, black, yellow, red, brown, lesbian, gay, straight, and bi. It's our differences that make us unique and worthwhile individuals. It's our class that should unite us in the struggle for a better world for ourselves, our children, and the many other life forms we share space with on this small blue ball.
And do not forget that women in this country, as well as women in the third world, are experiencing these kind of massacres. Women in the third world, countries like Korea, Taiwan, other third world countries, Indonesia, where women and men and children are making our durable goods for this country, for us in the first world, they're still experiencing the same kind of brutality that is so rampant in our history.
And I'm sorry to say that for some reason that seems to be a couple minutes longer than 45, so I don't know how they did that on a 45-minute tape. But anyway, this is Judy Berry. It was just about done, so you'll just have to give up on it. Anyway, this is Judy Berry, and this has been the Punch and Judy Show. You've been listening to a tape of Jean Lawhorn and Leslie Helmstreet. Jean Lawhorn, labor historian from Portland, telling about women in labor history. The Punch and Judy Show has been brought to you by the environment, by the members and the Mendocino Environmental Center, a membership organization at 468-1660.